Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's McAllister, Book 2, The Killing, by William W. Johnstone with J.A. Johnstone. Narrated by Mort Shelby. With performances by Stephen Carpenter, Terrence Aislefield, Mort Shelby, Colleen Delaney, Thomas Keegan, Michael John Casey, James Lewis, Nick DePinto, Christopher Graybill, Eric Mesner, Danny Gavigan, Michael Glenn, Bradley Smith, Dylan Lynch, Tim Carlin, Kimberly Gilbert, David Coyne, Johan Detweiler, Scott McCormick, Tim Pavone, Lily Beacon, Ken Jackson, Jeff Allen, Casey Platt, Christopher Shearer, Thomas Penny, Joe Brack, Nanette Savard, James Konachek, Evan Casey, Yasmin Quazan, Gary Tell, Sherry Berg, and Joel Santner. Duff Tavish McAllister was a tall man with golden hair, wide shoulders, and muscular arms. At the moment, he was sitting in the swing on the front porch of his ranch house in the Chugwater Valley of southeastern Wyoming. This particular vantage point afforded him a view of the rolling grassland, the swiftly moving stream of Bear Creek, and steep red escarpments to the south. He had title to 12,000 acres, but even beyond that, he had free use of tens of thousands more acres, the perimeters limited only by the sage-covered mountains whose peaks were snow-capped 10 months of the year. He had once owned a cattle ranch in Scotland, but it wasn't called a ranch. It was called a farm, and he only had 300 acres of land. Duff was a Highlander, meaning that he was from the highlands of Scotland. But compared to the magnificent mountains in the American West, the highlands were but hills. In the corral, his horse, Skye, felt the need for exercise and began running around the outside edge of the corral at nearly top speed.
I was talking to Guthrie yesterday. He said if I wanted to build a machine shed, he could get the plans and all the material together for me. But I'm not so sure I need another building now. What do you think, Elmer?
Elmer Gleason was Duff's foreman, and at the moment, he was sitting on the top level of the steps that led up to the porch. Elmer was wiry and raw-boned. He had a full head of white hair and a neatly trimmed beard.
It appears to me, Duff, like you near about got everything done it needs doing in order to get this ranch going. I don't see no need for you to be building a machine shed till you get yourself some cows.
I expect you're right.
No, I say this. Once you get them critters here, there won't be a cow in Wyoming living in a finer place than Sky Meadow.
Duff's house, which was no more than a cabin just a year ago, was now as fine a structure as could be found anywhere on the Wyoming range. Made of debarked logs fit together, then chinked with mortar, it was 60 feet wide and 40 feet deep, with a porch that stretched all the way around the front. Duff's ranch was set between the Bear and Little Bear Creeks, both streams year-round sources of good water. In an area where good water was scarce, the creeks were worth as much as the gold mine that was on the extreme western end of his property. Duff gazed thoughtfully across the rolling green pasture land to Bear Creek, a meandering ribbon of silver. He followed it with his eyes as far as he could see. The insulating mountains not only made for beautiful scenery, but they tempered the winter winds, and throughout the spring and summer, they sent down streams of water to make the grass grow green. Over the past year, he had come to love this piece of ground, and had put in long hours each day getting it ready to become the ranch he knew it could be. He had named his ranch Sky Meadow, not only because the elevation of the valley was at 5,000 feet, but also because it kept alive the memory of Sky McGregor, the woman he would have married had she not been murdered back in Scotland.
Where are you, Duff?
Beg your pardon?
You've been gazing out over the land here for the last 5 minutes without saying a word. You've been looking at the land, but I'll just bet you ain't seeing it. Your mind is somewhere else, I think.
You're partly right, and partly wrong. I was foreseeing my land, for I find the view to my liking and soothing to my soul. But 'tis right you are that my mind was back in Scotland.
You thinking of your woman, huh?
Aye, the lass was much on my mind. 'Tis a shame I have all this and no one to share it with me.
You're a young man, Duff. You'll not be single all your life, I'm betting. What about the young woman who runs that dress shop in Chugwater?
You'd be talking about Megan Parker, I expect.
Well, who else would I be talking about? Of course I'm talking about Megan Parker. She's all sass and spirit, with a face as brown as all outdoors, yellow hair bright as the sun. She's pretty as a newborn colt and trusting as a loyal dog. Why, she could capture your heart in a minute if you would but give her the chance.
Elmer, 'tis a bit of the poet you have in that ancient soul of yours.
Well, I wasn't always a poor castaway creature of the desert.
Elmer was Duff's only ranch hand. When Duff came to take possession of his land last year, he'd heard stories of a ghost in the old abandoned and played out mine that was on his property. When he'd examined his mine, he had found the ghost who had kept others frightened away. And he'd also found that the mine was anything but played out. The ghost was Elmer, who was protecting his stake in the mine. At the time, Elmer was more wild than civilized, and he'd been living on bugs and rabbits when he could catch them, and such wild plants as could be eaten. By rights and deed, the mine belonged to Duff, but he had wound up taking Elmer in as partner in the operation of the mine. And that move was immediately vindicated when, shortly thereafter, Elmer saved Duff's life. The two men became friends then, and over the last year, Duff had seen occasional glimpses into Elmer's mysterious past. Although Elmer had never told him the full story of his life and seldom released more than a bit of information at a time, Duff was gradually learning about him. He knew that Elmer had been to China as a crewman on a clipper ship. Elmer had lived for 2 years with the Indians, married to an Indian woman who died while giving birth to their son. Elmer didn't know where his son, who would be 10, now was. He had left him with his wife's sister and had not seen him since the day he was born. And once, Elmer had even let it slip that he had ridden the outlaw trail with Jesse and Frank James. Because of the gold mine, Elmer had money now, more money than he had ever had in his life. He could easily leave Wyoming and go on to San Francisco to live out the rest of his life in ease and comfort, but he had no desire to do so.
I got a good roof over my head, good friend, all the tobacco I can chew. Why would I be wanting to go anywhere else?
Elmer stood up and walked over to the fence line to relieve himself. Just before he did, though, he jumped back in alarm.
Oh, damn!
What is it? What's wrong?
There's rattlesnake here!
Duff got up from the swing and walked to the front of the porch.
Where is it?
Right over there! If an eye had been going through the gate, I would have got bit.
I see him.
Duff pulled his pistol and aimed it.
You ain't gonna try to shoot it from way back there, are you? Some bitch! Now, I've been to war and sailed the seas and I've seen me a goat roping, but I ain't never seen shooting like that.
Elmer reached down and picked up the carcass, and then, laying it on the top rung of the fence, he pulled out his knife and began skinning it.
What are you doing?
I'm gonna make us a couple of snakeskin hat bands, and we're gonna have us some fried rattlesnake for supper.
After supper that evening, consisting of batter-fried rattlesnake, fried potatoes, and sliced onion, the two worked together to wash the dishes and clean up the kitchen. Then they went back out onto the front porch.
Oh, I never thought I'd eat rattlesnake, but that was good.
Well, you can eat pretty nigh everything if you know how to cook it.
Hey, and I'm sure you'd know how to cook it.
I ate meat Tasmanian devil once. We put into an island just off Australia. Tougher than a mule he was. Had him a strong stink, too. But after 6 weeks at sea with naught but weevily biscuits and moldering fatback and beans, well, it weren't all that hard to get around the stink.
Elmer, 'tis thinking I am that I'll be going back to Scotland.
What?
But not to stay, mind you, but for a bit of a visit. I received a letter from Ian telling me that there are no charges against me, and there's no danger in my returning.
When would you be leaving?
I'll ride to Cheyenne tomorrow and take the train the next day. I'll leave from New York 2 weeks from today.
Oh, well, how long you be gone?
Nay, more than 2 months, I'm thinking. Then when I come back, I'll be forgetting some cattle on the place. What is it?
I didn't want to say anything, you being a boss and all, but I was beginning to wonder if I was going to have to tell you that in order to have a cattle ranch, you need to have some cattle.
Oh, I knew we need cattle. That's not the question. The question is what kind of cattle we need.
What do you mean what kind of cattle do we need? Longhorns is the easiest. Hey, bud, lots of folks are raising Herefords now. Is that what you're thinking?
No, I'm thinking about introducing an entirely new breed.
Really? What kind?
Black Angus. The kind that I raised back in Scotland.
Is that why you're going back to Scotland? To get some of them black, what'd you call them?
Angus. Black Angus.
Well, now that seems kind of foolish, don't it? I mean, going all the way back to Scotland to get some kind of special cow when you got Herefords right here.
That's not why I'm going back to Scotland. I'm going back in order that I might give a proper goodbye to those that I left so suddenly.
Oh, proper goodbye. Yeah. Yeah, I can see that.
Scotland, Dunoon, in Argyllshire. Duff stood in the middle of the cemetery between the Redeemer Presbyterian Church in Dunoon in Argyllshire, holding a spray of heather in his hand. He looked down at the grave. The stone read, Skye MacGregor, 1866 to 1886, beloved daughter of Ian and Margaret. A light of love, too quickly extinguished in this world, now shining ever brightly in heaven above. Duff knelt to place the flowers on the well-tended grave, then put his hand on the marble tombstone. Saying a silent prayer, he stood, then walked a half mile to the White Horse Pub. The pub was filled with customers when Duff stepped inside, and he stood there unnoticed. Ian MacGregor, the owner of the pub, had his back to the bar as he was filling a mug with ale. For just a moment, Duff had a start, for there was a young woman the same size and with the same red hair as Skye waiting on the customers. But the illusion was destroyed when she turned. Ian had just handed the ale to the customer and was about to put the money into the cash register when he looked toward the door.
Duff!
So many people swarmed toward Duff that he was immediately surrounded. All wanted to shake his hand or pat him on the back. Duff smiled and greeted each one of them warmly as they escorted him over to one of the tables. As he sat, Ian placed a glass of scotch in front of him.
And would you be for staying here, no lad?
Nay, 'tis but a visit.
Now remember, 'tis no charge being placed against you. Three witnesses there were who testified that you acted in self-defense.
Aye, it was explained to me in a letter. But I've started a ranch, I've made friends, and I've begun a new life in America.
Then what brings you to Scotland?
As you recall, I had to leave very quickly. I had no time to say a proper goodbye to Skye. It is ashamed I was that I was not here for her funeral.
You were here, lad. Maybe not in the flesh, but there wasn't a person in the church, nay, nor in the cemetery, when she was lowered into the ground, that didna feel your presence.
Aye, for with all my heart and soul, I was here.
Well,
Ian had to get back to work, but for the next 2 hours, Duff was kept busy telling his friends about America. Finally, when the last customer had left, Duff and Ian sat together in the pub, dark now except for a single light that glowed dimly behind the bar.
Have you made friends, Duff?
Aye. Good friends, for all that they are new.
Duff told Ian about Biff Johnson, whose wife was Scottish, and Fred Matthews and R.W. Guthrie. He told him about Elmer Gleason as well.
As odd a man as ever you might meet, but as loyal and true a friend as you might want.
Have you left anything out, lad?
What do you mean?
You've made no mention of a woman. Is there no woman that's caught your fancy?
I don't know.
You dunno know, but how can it be that you dunno know?
I have met a young woman. Handsome, spirited, gritty.
Handsome, spirited, gritty? Duff, you could be talking about a horse. Surely there's more.
I dunno. Skye, it's just that...
Skye isn't here, laddie. And if she could speak from her grave, she would tell you nay to be closing your heart on her account.
Aye, I believe that is true. But Skye is in a corner of my heart, Ian. And I cannae get her out.
There's no need for you to get Skye out of your heart. But keep her in that corner, so you have room to let another in.
You're a good man, Ian McGregor. 'Tis proud I would have been to be her son-in-law.
Duff, oh, Duff, sure in you are my son-in-law, in my eyes and in the eyes of God, if not in the eyes of the law.
The next day, Duff visited Brian Wallace. Wallace was one of the most knowledgeable men about cattle that Duff had ever met, and he was the same stock breeder who had provided him with the cattle he'd used to start his own small farm before he'd left Scotland. After a warm greeting, Duff filled him in on where he'd been for the last 2 years.
I've built a nice ranch with good grazing land, water, and protection from the winter's cold blast. And now the time has come for me to put cattle upon the land. Most would say I should raise Longhorn, for surely they are the most common of all the cattle there, and they are easy to raise. But there are some who are raising Herefords, and 'tis said that I might try that as well.
Aye, Herefords are a good breed, and they'll do well in the American West.
But I'm remembering with fondness the Black Angus I was raising here, and 'tis wondering I am if you could be telling me a bit of the background of the Black Angus.
Aye, would be happy to, for 'tis a story of Scotland itself. A man by the name of Hugh Watson was raising hornless cattle in Aberdeenshire and Angus. Donnies they were called then, and good cattle they were. But Watson thought to improve them, so he began selecting only the best black polled animals for his herd. His favourite bull was Old Jock, who was born 1842 and sired by Grey-breasted Jock. Today, if you look in the Scottish herd book, you'll be foreseeing that Old Jock was given the number one. In that same herd was a cow named Old Granny. Old Granny produced many calves, and today, every Black Angus that is registered can trace its lineage back to those two cows.
And how would the cows do in America?
You'd be thinking of raising Black Angus on the new ranch of yours, are you?
Aye, if I thought they would do well there.
Ease your mind, laddie. They do just fine in America, for they are there already.
Really? In Wyoming?
Nay, I think they'll be none in Wyoming, but they are in Kansas, Missouri, and Mississippi. and there is already an American Aberdeen Angus Association which has their headquarters in Chicago. If you be for wanting information about the breed in America, I would say that's where you should go.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace.
You'll be going back to America then, will you?
Aye, I've set down my roots there now.
What do you think of the country?
'Tis as big and as wonderful as you can possibly imagine.
Do me a favour, lad, and drop me a line when you get your herd established. I've been keeping track of where all the Black Angus have been started. 'Tis a thing I do for the Scottish Breeders Association.
I'll be happy to.
Jugwater, Wyoming Territory. When Megan Parker fetched her mail from the post office, she was surprised and pleased to find a letter from Duff McAllister. She rushed home and excitedly started to open it. Then, just before opening the flap, she hesitated.
What if he's telling me that he's not coming back? What if he's writing to tell me that he's going to stay in Scotland? No. Surely he wouldn't do that. He's got a ranch here. He's made friends here.
But he was from Scotland, and though Megan didn't know all the particulars, she did know that he had been in love there, and that the love, for some reason, was unrequited. Of course, she was just being silly, thinking about all this anyway. In the past year, Duff had made no overtures beyond being just friendly to her. He'd even come to a few of the dances, and while there, he had danced with her, but even then he'd been somewhat reticent, refusing to occupy too much of her time because the single men so outnumbered the single women that she was always very much in demand.
Still, it does seem like he goes out of his way to speak to me or find some reason to see me on his infrequent visits to town. Oh, God, is this a letter of goodbye? There's only one way to find out, Megan, and that's to open it.
Dear Miss Parker, even as I pen the words upon the page of this missive, I'm gazing out over the moors, lochs, and highlands of my beautiful Scotland, and I find myself wondering why I ever left its shores. Then I think of the beauty of my ranch, Sky Meadow, and the joys of the friends I've made since I came there, and I know that America is truly my new home. I will be back within 1 month of your receipt of this letter. My visit here has been both personal and for business, and I now know the next step I'm going to take with my ranch. I hope your memory of me has been kept green in my absence. Yours truly, Duff McAllister.
Chicago, Illinois. On his way back from Scotland, Duff stopped by the American Aberdeen Angus Association in Chicago, and after a few preliminary questions, he was directed to a man named Eli Woodson.
Yes, sir, Mr. McAllister. We are absolutely encouraging the expansion of Angus cattle in America. And you say that you've been around them before?
Aye. When I was in Scotland, I was growing the breed.
Good, good. Then I won't have to be selling you on them, will I? You know what a fine breed they are. Tell me, where will you be ranching?
In eastern Wyoming, in a place called Chugwater Valley.
Oh, wonderful. Wyoming is a big cattle area. It'd be good to have the noble Angus represented there.
My question now is, where do I purchase the animals?
Well, I can set you up with a bull and maybe 10 heifers from here. You can ship them back on the train.
Thank you, but I'd like to start with a much bigger herd.
How large is much bigger?
I want at least 500 head.
You intend to start your herd with 500 head?
Aye.
Mr. McAllister, do you have any idea how much something like that would cost?
I think no more than $30 a head. Maybe a little less. And I can do the math.
Well now, if you're fully aware of the cost of starting a herd with such a number and nevertheless want to pursue it, I'm sure we can find enough cattle for you. How long will you be in Chicago?
I plan to take the train to Cheyenne tomorrow.
You have a hotel for tonight?
I do. I'll be staying at the Palmer House.
Good. Enjoy your stay there while I do some research. I'll telephone the front desk at the Palmer House and leave a message for you when I get the information you need.
Thank you.
The next morning, Duff awoke and went downstairs to the lobby of the Palmer House. He checked with the clerk, and there was indeed a message waiting for him. Duff took the message over to one of the sofas in the lobby and sat there as he unfolded it to read.
The Kansas City Cattle Exchange can make all the arrangements to provide you with Black Angus cattle. Good luck with your enterprise. Woodson.
Smiling, Duff put the note in his pocket. As soon as he got back to Wyoming, he would contact the Kansas City Cattle Exchange and make whatever arrangements might be necessary. A week after arriving back in Chugwater, Duff and Elmer Gleason were sitting on the front porch of Duff's house.
Elmer, 'tis thinking I am that tomorrow I'll ride into Cheyenne.
You'll be back come Saturday, won't you?
Aye, I'm thinking that I will be. What's so important about Saturday?
Oh, there's a fireman's benefit dance at the Dunn Hotel Ballroom on Saturday.
Aye. Being as I've been gone for 2 months, I'd nearly forgotten about that.
Yeah, well, maybe you forgot it. You can be certain that Miss Parker ain't forgot it. More than likely, she's planning on you asking for to take her. Especially since you've been gone for 2 months.
I'll be back before Saturday, but I'm not for sure exactly when it will be. Mayhaps you can ask Miss Parker to the dance for me.
Duff McAllister! Now, I may have spent the last 20 years in the desert, the mountains, or at sea, but even I know that ain't right. You need to ask her for yourself. That's what you need to do.
Aye, you're right, I'm sure. But let me ask you this. Would you be for delivering a letter to her for me?
Letter, huh? Yeah, that I'd be willing to do. You write it tonight and leave it on the sideboard. I'll ride into town tomorrow and deliver it.
The next morning, a stagecoach left Turkville, Kansas, bound for Hays City, which was the nearest railroad connection. There were no other coaches and only a few wagons or other conveyances on the road. It was hot and dusty, and only those whose business, whether professional or personal, was important enough to get them out into the dust and the heat, ventured to make the trip. There were 4 passengers in the coach, and though it was designed to carry 9, the fact that there were only 4 made the trip somewhat more bearable, if not comfortable. One was Dooley Long, a gambler who was headed to the nearest railroad depot with the intention of taking the cards to what he hoped would be more profitable pickings in San Francisco. Mildred Luke, pretty, ruby-cheeked, blue-eyed, young auburn-haired girl, was only 17 but was put on the coach by her father, the sheriff of Dawson County, for a visit with her grandparents who lived in Plum Creek. Dr. Philip Rosen and his wife intended to take the train east to Chicago to attend a medical convention there. Up on the box, Sam Schaefer, the driver, and Vernon Westbrook, the shotgun guard, kept their eyes peeled for any danger they might encounter. The passengers were occupied with their own thoughts or engaged in light and sporadic conversation, and thus they were unaware of the stage driver and the shotgun guard who were scanning the road and the adjacent trees and brush on the watch for would-be robbers. At noon, the stage stopped at the Armada Way station, where the passengers and stage crew had their lunch. Then, after a lunch of bacon, fried potatoes, and biscuits, the coach rolled out of Armada in a cloud of dust. Dr. Rosen was nervously looking out of the windows of the coach now.
I don't like this part of the trip. This is where Crack Kingsley held up the stage last month.
He didn't kill anyone, did he?
No. But he well could have. You never know with someone like Crack Kingsley. He served 5 years in the penitentiary. He didn't learn anything. He's still riding the outlaw trail. But I reckon that all started during the war. He was an irregular then, robbing, burning, and killing without compunction.
Which side was he on?
He rode with Doc Jennison. So you might say he was a Union man, but from what I've heard, the Jayhawkers were no better than the Bushwhackers who rode for the South.
Dr. Rosen's observation had everyone in the stage on edge, and they looked out the windows as vigilantly as did the driver and guard. Up ahead by the side of the road was a single, rather large rock, ideally positioned to shelter a road agent should one wish to take advantage. Schaefer was well aware of this part of the trip, for that very rock had hidden Kingsley last month. Outside, Schaefer cracked his whip to hurry the team by.
Oh! What was that?
Oh, not to worry, child. That was just Mr. Schaefer popping his whip over the heads of the horses.
The stage rolled on by the rock and then past a grove of aspens and cottonwood trees that were ideal for harboring a robber or robbers. The road angled down from there, still paralleling the stream running clear and cold among the rocks. Then the road started up a long, slow ascent, with the stream dropping off so that one could look down upon it breaking wide over the rocks and sparkling brightly in the sunshine. As the coach continued to climb, Mildred felt cold shivers run down her spine. From every bush, stump, and rock, she expected a masked man to leap out before her. Finally reaching the top of the hill, the horses were allowed to rest for a few minutes, and the passengers were encouraged to step out to stretch their legs. It was not mere coincidence that here were two privies, the ladies on the left side of the road, the men's on the right. Crack Kingsley had been waiting behind a clump of bushes about 20 yards from the ladies' privy. Subconsciously, he rubbed his finger across the puffed-up purple scar tissue on his face. He had watched the passengers step out, the driver get down to check the harness, and the shotgun guard leave his gun on the seat while he went into the toilet to relieve himself. Kingsley had waited in this place for just such an opportunity, and he walked up to the right side of the team so he'd be able to keep an eye on the men as they came back to the coach. The driver, having found a loose line, was so busy adjusting it that he didn't notice Kingsley until he spoke.
Now, gents, this is what I want you to do. Drop your guns right here on this side of the log.
He was referring to a fallen tree of about 4 feet in diameter. The driver and the shotgun guard pulled their pistols and dropped them as Kingsley ordered.
I'm a doctor. I don't carry a gun.
What about you?
Dooley Long pulled his pistol from the holster and dropped it alongside the log.
You look to me like the kind of person who carries a holdout. Let me see it.
Long hesitated a moment, and Kingsley pointed his pistol at him.
I'll just shoot you now and be done with it.
Long pulled a small pistol from his jacket pocket and dropped it with the other two weapons. At that moment, Mildred and Mrs. Rosen emerged from their privy.
Kingsley
jerked his pistol over in her direction.
Damn, have I gotten famous? Get over here where I can keep an eye on you two.
You'll never get away with this, Mr. Kingsley. My daddy is the sheriff of Dawson County.
Is he now? Well, you tell your daddy. Crack Kingsley sends his regards. Now, you, driver, climb up there and throw down the money box.
Mr. Kingsley, maybe you should have scouted this out a little bit better than you done. We ain't carrying no money box on this trip.
What do you mean you ain't carrying no money? You always carry money.
No, sir, we don't always. Lots of times now, what money there is going back and forth to the railroad is took by the courier. We ain't carrying no money at all, and that's the Lord's truth.
You, Sheriff's daughter, climb up there on the driver's seat and take a look around.
Frightened, Mildred did as she was instructed, climbing with some difficulty because of her dress up onto the driver's seat.
Now, look under that seat and throw down what you see.
Mildred looked under the seat, then rose up again.
There's nothing under the seat.
Don't you be lying to me, girl. Because I'd as soon kill you as any of the others. Now throw down what you see up there, whether it be a pouch or a box.
Please, there's nothing up here.
Damn. All right, come on down from there. Come here.
Suddenly and unexpectedly, Kingsley grabbed the top of her dress and jerked it down, exposing her bare breast.
Now, if you don't want to see this girl hurt, you'll empty your pockets of any money you're carrying and put it right here in my hat.
Dr. Rosen had a $10 and a $20 gold piece. Dooley Long put one $20 gold piece in the hat.
Mister,
The way you're dressed, I don't think this is all the money you got. Now, I'm going to ask you again to empty your pockets, and then I'm going to come over there and reach down in your pocket my own self, and if I find any money you was holding out on me, I'll kill you.
Nervously, the gambler produced 3 more $20 gold pieces. The driver and guard came up with $30 between them.
What about you?
She's my wife. I carry our money.
How much money do you have, girl?
Mildred was still standing alongside the coach with her arms folded across her bare breasts.
I have $5.
You're traveling and you only have $5?
I don't need any more. I'm going to see my grandmother and grandfather.
Well, I tell you what, honey. For letting me get a peek of them little titties, I'll let you keep your money.
Oh, you are a despicable human being.
Yeah, I reckon I am. All right, all you folks climb up into the coach now. Driver, you get on out of here. I'll just stay here and keep an eye on you till you're gone.
With that, everyone climbed back into the stage, and it rolled away.
$140.
Kingsley had thought he might get as much as $500 from a cash box, but given that he had less than $20 before he had begun this afternoon's adventure, he was satisfied enough. Megan Parker was 23 years old, quite pretty with blonde hair and blue eyes. At the moment, she was in the Ladies' Emporium, a dress shop that she owned. She was on her knees with her mouth full of pins as she pinned up the hem of the dress she was making for Mrs. Abernathy.
We're going to Philadelphia. My sister-in-law thinks that all the women out here wear dresses made of buckskin and flour sacks. I simply must have a dress that will make her pea green with envy. My niece is getting married next month.
Turn to the left. You look beautiful in this dress. You'll be the belle of the wedding, next to the bride, of course. Turn a little more to your left.
So when are you?
I beg your pardon? When am I what?
When are you getting married?
Oh, I don't know. But shouldn't I be engaged first, before I start thinking about such a thing?
You mean Duff McAllister hasn't asked you to marry him?
No. Whatever gave you that idea? Mr. McAllister and I are just good friends, that's all.
Uh-huh. Just good friends. Or so you say.
There. I've got it all pinned up. Now you go back in the dressing room and take it off, but be very careful that you don't lose any of the pins.
You don't want to talk about it, do you?
Talk about what?
Never mind. If you don't want to talk about it, we won't. But you know I'm right.
Megan walked into the front with a smile to greet her customer. When she saw Elmer Gleason standing there, the smile left her face.
Elmer, is something wrong? Did something happen to Duff?
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. Ain't nothing at all like that. Now, I'm sorry I put a fear into you, Miss Megan.
Oh, no, I'm the one who should apologize. I have no idea what might have made me think such a thing.
Well, now, what it is I bring you a letter from Duff. He being in Cheyenne for a couple days, he asked me if I'd bring this to you.
Elmer pulled the letter from his shirt pocket and held it out toward her.
I tried to keep it clean as best I could, but you know what, with the ride and all, it might got a little smudged up.
It's fine, thank you very much. Oh, would you like some coffee and cookies? I have some made for my customers.
Oh, no, thank you kindly, ma'am, but being as they're for your customers, why, I wouldn't want to get into them. Besides which, I done promised Mr. Matthews I'd meet him down at Fiddler's Green.
All right. Thank you, Elmer. Thank you very much for bringing Duff's letter to me.
Yes, ma'am. You're welcome. Oh, you know, ma'am, he puts a great deal of store in you.
So, you're just friends, huh? Didn't mean to startle you.
Mrs. Abernathy was holding the carefully pinned up dress in her hands, and she extended it toward Megan.
I was real careful with the pins.
Good.
So, what's in the letter? Will he be coming to the fireman's ball this Saturday?
I'll have your dress ready before 4 tomorrow.
I see. Thank you, dear. That will be very nice.
Megan waited until Mrs. Abernathy was gone before she opened Duff's letter.
Dear Miss Parker, it may seem strange to have a missive from me presented to you by Elmer Gleason, but he has generously offered to act as a means of posting this letter. By the time you read this, I shall be in Cheyenne. While in Cheyenne, I intend to make arrangements to bring cattle onto my land so that, after a year of preparation, Sky Meadow will truly become a cattle ranch. I'm sure that the news of my establishing a ranch is important to you only as a matter of the friendship that exists between the two of us. However, there may come a time when this information would be of much greater interest to you. I am told that there is to be a dance on the evening of Saturday next, the purpose of which is to raise funds for the Volunteer Fire Brigade. Because I deem this a worthy purpose, I have every intention of attending the function, and I hope that you do as well. If so, I would be delighted to share a few dances with you should you grant me that opportunity. Sincerely, Duff Tavish McAllister.
Was Mrs. Abernathy correct in her appraisal of Duff McAllister's regard for her? It was certainly no secret to her friends, though Megan hadn't told anyone, that she had feelings for Duff. But her sense of propriety dictated that she say nothing to him before he declared himself to her. And her sense of self-preservation prevented her from investing too much of herself in the relationship until she knew that there could actually be such a thing. She had seen him only briefly since he'd returned from his trip to Scotland. He'd stopped into her shop the next day to visit with her. And what made the visit particularly pleasant was that he had brought her something from Scotland. It was a souvenir plate with a traditional Scotsman playing the pipes in front of Edinburgh Castle, with Edinburgh at the top of the plate. She treasured it, not so much for what it was, as for the fact that he'd thought to bring her something. She was pleased to get the letter, but it seemed oddly impersonal, though there was that one particular intriguing part of the letter.
I'm sure that the news of my establishing a ranch is important to you only as a matter of the friendship that exists between the two of us. However, there may come a time when this information would be of much greater interest to you.
What does that mean? Why would there ever be a time when information about his ranch would be of much greater interest to me? Does Duff think of me as a part of his future?
Megan was fully aware that such a relationship might never develop between them. There was much about Duff McAllister to admire. He was handsome, yes. And in less than 1 year, he had earned the respect and esteem of just about everyone in the valley. But there was something else about him, too. Something deep and dark. It took a while before Duff was comfortable enough with Megan to tell him about the love he had lost in Scotland. That had left this otherwise very powerful man with a wounded and vulnerable soul. And as much as she wanted to have a deeper relationship, the thought of doing further emotional damage to him was more than she wanted to deal with. She would have to go slow. After Elmer delivered Duff's letter to Megan Parker, he stepped into Fiddler's Green. He was feeling pretty good about things, because while he hadn't read the letter, he knew from their conversation that Duff was going to ask her about the dance. Sky Meadow needed a woman on the place, and Duff needed a wife. Elmer knew about Sky McGregor, and he could understand a man grieving over the loss of a true love. But Duff needed to get on with his life. Otherwise, he'd wind up wasting it away, the way Elmer had. He hadn't started out to waste his life. When he was young, he'd had plans like every other young man. All he wanted to do was have a farm, marry Alma Doomy, and raise a family. But all that changed with the war. Jesse James walked up to young Elmer with a grim look on his face.
Alma's dead, Elmer. A bunch of red-legged bastards from Kansas killed her and her whole family.
Was it Doc Jennison?
Worse. They were led by one of our own, Crack Kingsley.
Kingsley? Kingsley did this?
I heard it from Alma's dying lips.
So far, Elmer had managed to avoid the war. He was in Missouri, and he knew that there were men of good conscience fighting on both sides. But avoiding the war didn't mean he was avoiding its price. He had already lost a brother, two cousins, and several friends. And now, Alma Doomy, the girl he had intended to marry, was dead. Elmer pinched the bridge of his nose to keep himself from crying in front of this man, who'd been his boyhood friend and was now an experienced warrior.
I know you haven't had any trouble with him before, but I never did like the son of a bitch. So to be truthful with you, I wasn't all that surprised when he crossed the border to join up with the Kansans. But I never thought he'd do anything like this to one of his own.
It's my fault. She wanted to marry this spring, but I wanted to put it off till after the crops were out. If she had been here with me, she'd still be alive.
You can ride with us, Elmer. I guarantee you, we'll find the son of a bitches who did this, and we'll make them pay.
Elmer did ride with Frank and Jesse James, and with Quantrill, and they did find some, but not all, of the men who had murdered the Doomy family. Crack Kingsley, the one who had led the Jayhawkers, got away. When the war ended, most of the soldiers were able to go home again to pick up their lives from before. But Elmer couldn't, because he and many of the men who had ridden with Quantrill and Bloody Bill Anderson were not considered soldiers. It didn't seem right. The men who rode with Doc Jennison, whose personal depravities equaled anything anyone who ever rode with Quantrill did, were regarded as heroes. But Elmer became a wanted man, unable to re-enter society. As a result, he continued to ride with Jesse and Frank James. Then, after the debacle of the Northfield raid, Elmer, who was nursing a bullet wound in the thigh, left the outlaw trail so he could heal up. Once he was healed, he decided not to go back on the trail. Instead, he went west. Elmer became a wanderer after that. He spent a year with the Brule Sioux, where he took a squaw, but he left after she died. Then he went to San Francisco, and trying to rescue a Chinese prostitute, he ran afoul of the Tong. He killed two Tong members and, to escape retribution, found his way to a sailor's hall. There, though he'd never been to sea in his life, he'd signed on to the Harriet Sutton, a clipper ship bound for the Orient. It had been quite a ride for Elmer since then, including a long period where he had lost his soul and nearly his life, only to be rescued by Duff McAllister. He had been a loner for as long as he could remember, and it was good to have a friend like Duff. As Elmer stood at the bar in Fiddler's Green, nursing his beer and wrestling with his thoughts, he became aware that someone at the opposite end of the bar was staring at him. It was a young man wearing a black hat with a silver headband, from which protruded a small red feather. He was also wearing a pistol, with the holster hanging low on his right side. The man was slender, with dark hair and narrow obsidian eyes. When he realized that Elmer had caught him staring, the young man tossed his drink down and wiped the back of his hand across his mouth. Then he turned to face Elmer.
"Hey, you, old man."
Elmer turned toward him and, by way of greeting, lifted his beer.
"Would you be Elmer Gleason?"
Elmer said nothing.
"Didn't you hear the question? I asked if you're Elmer Gleason."
"I'm Gleason."
"They tell me you rode with Jesse James. Is that right, Mr. Gleason?"
Again, Elmer was silent.
"You know what? I don't believe you rode with Jesse James at all. I think that's just a lie you've been spreading around, hoping it would make people think you're somebody."
Elmer picked up his beer, then walked around behind the bar. He sat the beer down on the bar and looked at the young man.
Look, appears to me like you and me got started on the wrong foot. Now, suppose I buy you a drink. What do you have?
I don't want nothing from you, Mr. Outlaw. Is there a price on your head for riding with Jesse James? If there is, how big is the reward? I might just collect on it.
I don't think there's any paper out on me.
Oh, you don't think? Well, mister, that might be the truest thing you've said so far. You gotta have a brain to think. And since you don't have no brain, then you don't think.
Damn. Don't look to me like I'm gonna be able to get onto your good side, does it?
Oh, now that there is a good one. Mister, maybe you don't know this, but I ain't got no good side for you to get on. Most especially with old, cowardly outlaws like you.
What's your name, boy?
The name is Cleet. Cleet Wilson. I reckon you've heard of me.
No, sir. I don't reckon I have.
You're lying. You've heard of me. And even now you're quaking in your boots.
Oh, you think so, do you, boy?
Don't call me boy. I just told you what my name is. If you want to talk to me, call me by my given name.
All right, Wilson. I'll call you by your name. Because it's important that you hear what I got to say. I don't know what your problem is, but I'm plumb worn out. And one thing about reaching my age is, well, I'm going to have to put up with assholes like you if I don't want to.
Well, that's just too bad, Mr. Gleason, because you're going to have to put up with it whether you want to or not.
Just what is it that you got sticking in your craw, son?
You, mister, you're sticking in my craw.
What, I killed someone close to you? Your father? Your brother? Huh?
No, nothing like that. I just want my name in the paper. And I figure that killing someone that used to ride with Jesse James will get my name in the paper.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know what else will get your name in the paper?
What?
It had not been mere restlessness that had caused Elmer to walk around to the back of that bar. Nor was it to offer to buy Wilson a drink. Elmer had walked around to the back of the bar to stand in front of the double-barrel Greener 12-gauge shotgun that Biff kept there. In a smooth and non-threatening motion, Elmer reached under the bar, wrapped his hand around the shotgun, and brought it up. He pointed the gun directly at Cleet Wilson and watched as the arrogant, overconfident smile faded.
You can also get your name in the paper by dying, and I'll be glad to oblige you in that.
What? No, no, wait. This ain't fair. You ain't even giving me a chance to go for my gun.
Fair? Who's talking about fair? You don't understand, do you, boy? I ain't no gunfighter like you, so there ain't gonna be nothing fair about this. This here's just gonna be a killing, plain and simple. You got any prayers, boy? You better say them now.
Please, mister, please don't kill me.
Elmer?
Elmer glanced over toward Biff.
Before you kill this little pissant, make him move away from the bar. That greener's gonna open up a hole big enough for you to drive a freight wagon through him. And that's gonna mean a lot of blood. It'll clean up pretty easy over there behind the stove, but it's harder than hell to clean up here, right in front of the bar.
Yeah, you're right, Biff. I don't see no need to put you through all that trouble. All right, boy. You heard the man. He wants the killing to be done over there, behind the stove. I reckon we just better move on over there.
Elmer came back around to the front of the bar. All the others who'd been standing at the bar moved over to the side wall. Those who had been sitting at tables moved as well, so there was nobody left on center stage except Elmer and Wilson. And Wilson was shaking uncontrollably. He sank down to his knees and then clasped his hands in front of him.
Please, Mr. Gleason, don't kill me.
Elmer let both hammers down.
I'm gonna let it pass this time. Almost.
Still gripping the shotgun by its stock, Elmer brought the barrel around in a vicious arc and landed it on the side of Wilson's head.
Damn it, Elmer! You went and got blood on the floor anyway.
Crack Kingsley had been riding for 8 hours. Behind him, like a line drawn across the desert floor, the darker color of hoof-churned earth stood out against the lighter, sun-baked ground. Before him, the Kansas plains stretched out, not in hills, but in motionless waves, one right after another. As each wave crested, another was exposed, and beyond that, another still. He'd filled his canteen in a creek this morning, and it was already down by a third. He had no idea how far it would be to the next dependable water hole, and already his tongue was so swollen with thirst that in a condition that was rare to him, he didn't have a cigar clenched between his teeth. As a means of preserving his water, he allowed himself no more than one swallow per hour. Squinting at the sun, he guessed that an hour had passed since last he'd allowed himself a drink. So he stopped his horse, mopped his brow, and reached for the canteen. The bullet hit his horse in the neck. Kingsley jumped clear to avoid being pinned beneath him. He pulled his rifle from its sheath, then ran to a nearby arroyo. He cocked his rifle, then slithered up to the top, lay his rifle on the parapet, and waited. There were three men approaching.
I told the sheriff he was turning back too fast. We got him now. We'll teach that son of a bitch not to treat women the way they done the sheriff's daughter.
I wouldn't be all that sure if I was you, Polk. All I'm seeing here is a horse. Don't see him nowheres.
Well, he's got to be around here somewheres. Well, he sure ain't gonna get far without a horse. Damn, where'd he go?
I reckon about the only thing we can do now is start back.
Kingsley stepped up out of the arroyo. His rifle was raised to his shoulder, and he was pointing it at Polk.
You boys give up too easy.
Oh, son of a bitch! It's him!
Polk made a panicked grab for his pistol, but even before his hand had reached it, Kingsley fired. Crack started toward the horses, aiming to capture one of them. They were all frightened by the gunshot and bolted away. He still had no horse, but he also knew now that there was nobody else on his trail. That meant he no longer had to avoid the towns, but could go on into the next one he saw. He had no choice now but to walk. It was hard going. An hour or so into his walk, his feet began to swell inside his boots. As the day wore on, he began tiring. The hot, dry air created a tremendous thirst, and the more he thought about it, the thirstier he got. His throat grew more and more parched, and his tongue swelled. He tried to keep up the schedule of one swallow of water per hour, but he was working much harder now than he had been when he was riding. It was nearly impossible to wait for an hour between swallows. In addition, there wasn't much water left. Then, just before dark, a scattering of weathered buildings rose from the plains before him, somewhat distorted in the shimmering heat waves. Gathering what strength he had remaining, Kingsley started toward it. Staggering into the little town, he saw a pump beside a horse watering trough and hurried to it. Never in his life had anything tasted any better to him. With the killing thirst satisfied, Kingsley rose up from the pump and looked around the town. No one moved, and Kingsley heard no human voice. Yet he knew there were people around. There were horses tied here and there, three of them in front of a building which was identified by a sign as the Silver Dollar Saloon. Kingsley walked over to make a closer examination of the three horses, looking at their teeth and their eyes and feeling their legs. He also examined the saddles, realizing that the more expensive the saddle, the more likely the horse is of good stock. The horses were inviting, and Kingsley thought about getting on one and just riding away right then. But the horses would still be here, and even more inviting for the moment was the thought of a cool beer. He'd made his selection, and given the horse a pat on the neck, he stepped up onto the porch, then pushed through the batwing doors to go inside. The shadowed interior of the saloon gave the illusion of coolness, but it was an illusion only, for the heat was just as impressive inside as it was outside. Kingsley stepped up to the bar and slapped a dime on the counter.
Beer!
The bartender drew the beer, then made change for the dime. Kingsley left the nickel on the bar, then picked up the beer and drained it without ever putting the mug down. Finished with the first beer, he used his finger to slide the nickel across the bar toward the bartender.
I'll have another one.
Mister, you sure come in here with some kind of thirst. What you been doing that's got you so thirsty?
What business is that of yours?
Mister, what was you doing looking at them horses so close?
Turning toward the front door, Kingsley saw a big man, easily 6'4" tall, staring at him. The man also wore a badge. At first, the badge startled him. Then he realized that if the lawman knew who he was, he would have called him by name. Instead, he was only questioning Kingsley's interest in the horses.
I'm a man that appreciates horses. I was just looking at them.
You walked into town, didn't you?
The man had a mustache that curved up at each end like the horns on a Texas steer. He was wearing a long-barreled Colt sheathed in a holster that was tied halfway down his leg. He had an angry, evil countenance. Looking directly at him was like staring into the eyes of an angry bull.
Suppose I did.
It just makes me wonder is all. I mean, you having such an appreciation for horse flesh.
My horse stepped into a hole just outside of town. He broke his leg and I had to shoot him.
Why don't you bring your saddle into town?
It's 10, maybe 12 miles out of town. Too far to be carrying a saddle.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm a generous man. Why don't I hitch up a buckboard and we'll just go out there and get your saddle?
Kingsley thought of the three men he had just killed, lying out there by his dead horse. At least one of them, he knew, was wearing a deputy's badge. It would not be good for this lawman to see that.
No need. I'm pretty tired from the walk. I plan to just leave it out there for now. Thought I might go back after it tomorrow.
That ain't no problem, mister. You don't have to go. I'll go get it for you.
No, you don't have to do that.
Mister, seems to me like Deputy Mosley is offering to do you a big favor riding out there to get your saddle for you. What you got against that?
I'll tell you what he has against it. He don't want me going out there because he knows there ain't no saddle out there. There ain't no saddle at all. He don't have a horse. He never did have a horse. He come into town with no other purpose than to steal one. Now that's the truth of it, ain't it, mister? Ain't you got nothing to say?
Seems to me like you're the one doing all the talking. Go on, if you think you got it all figured out.
I got it all figured out, all right. By the way you was looking over them horses out front, I know you was planning to. Which one was you gonna take? Calhoun's horse? I seen the way you was looking at him.
I ain't stole no horse.
Tell you what, why don't I just put you in jail? Then when the judge gets here next month, you can tell him that you wasn't planning on stealing a horse.
You ain't putting me in no jail.
Kingsley started for his gun, and seeing him, Deputy Mosley made his own move. But he wasn't fast enough. Out of the corner of his eye, Kingsley saw the bartender reaching under the bar. Knowing that many bartenders keep shotguns under their bars, Kingsley swung his gun around. Kingsley turned his gun then toward the others in the saloon, but with their hands up, they backed away. Kingsley glared at him, then turned and ran out the front door. Mounting the horse the deputy had identified as Calhoun's, he turned his pistol on the other two and shot him down to slow down any immediate pursuit. Once out of town, Kingsley made a wide turn, then circled back to the east and south. If a posse came after him, they'd be looking for him in West Kansas, but he was planning to go to Missouri. He hadn't been to Missouri since the war, and as far as he knew, nobody was looking for him there.